Okay, perfect. Okay, Erev Tov. We have the third Chag Urim Sameach, Happy Hanukkah. Mm-hmm. We have a third installment of the story behind the writing of the Shulchan Aruch, and we're up to part three. And part three is very much, it's a self-contained unit, but it's also a continuation of the previous two units. So what have we seen in the last two units? We've seen the fact that, first of all, Rav Yosef Karo realized the need to write this massive encyclopedic work called, what was it called? The
I mean, he did the Shulchan Aruch.
Yeah, what's the name of it? The Beit Yosef.
The Beit Yosef first, yes.
Which, in which he collects all of the previous Rishonim and all their commentaries on the Gemara. And then he determines the halacha based on the big three. The big three are the Rambam, the Rif, and Rabbeinu Asher. And he picks majority rules, and he's trying to create a universal halacha for all Jews, which he thinks will be binding on them throughout the world. That's the work of the Beit Yosef. Then we spoke about in the second shiur that about the story of the Rama of Moshe Israelis. Do you remember his story? Remember what happened?
So he did something on his own,
exactly.
And then realized that using, interestingly, the same concept, I think, of different...
Yeah. Of collecting all of the different opinions, because everything was scattered. And
but he also had a majority of rule.
He had a different methodology of Psak Halacha. So he also wanted to collect everything, but in the middle of his work, the Beit Yosef comes out, and he realizes that the Beit Yosef is far superior to anything that he was going to create. So he decides in the end to write what's called the Darchei Moshe, which is a commentary to the Turim, to the Arba'at Turim of Rav Yaakov ben Asher. And this commentary contains Ashkenazi customs, because the Beit Yosef, he wasn't interested at all in Ashkenazi customs, and he certainly wasn't interested in local, indigenous, regional customs. He wanted to know, go back to the text, go back to the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush, and determine the halacha through their conceptual analysis, not based on local custom. But he writes that he was so saddened. I mean, he was in anguish when he realized that his life's work was useless.
It's very poignant, the passage we read last time.
Yeah, it's really powerful, really powerful. But he found redemption by writing the Darchei Moshe. 10 years later then, the Shulchan Aruch realizes, he backtracks, and he realizes that his attempt to create an encyclopedia of all of halacha, of all of Jewish sources, while it's very useful, it's still impossible to follow al pi halacha. Like, what do you do practically? So what does he do? He creates the Shulchan Aruch. He condenses it and creates a bare bones, the sparsest of codes, which just tells you purely the halacha, what you have to do. Now, what are some of the features of the Shulchan Aruch? First of all, it's based on the categorization of the Arba'at Turim. Okay? It only focuses on practical halacha, unlike the Rambam, which focused on all areas of halacha, things that are relevant today and not relevant. Also, he does not tell you anything about his ideology. You don't know, he doesn't say, well, here's a rationale for the mitzvot, or here's a philosophical explanation, or here's a mystical explanation. It is pure halacha. This is what you have to do without any ideological underpinnings. The Rambam has a philosophical underpinning. The others, the Arizal, has a mystical underpinning, right? The Shulchan Aruch Harav of the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, also has a Hasidic or mystical underpinnings to his, how he understands halacha, that infuses and imbues halacha with a certain level of meaning. The Shulchan Aruch is just pure halacha, and that's it. He doesn't present a philosophical framework for it, in any sense of the word. And that's the...
But is there Kabbalah inside? I mean,
well, he was
for the Lulav, and there's some customs.
No, so he doesn't say that. He wasn't Mikubal. Right. And he did have interactions with an angel, which he writes about in a book called... which he records in a sefer called Magid Mesharim. Mm-hmm. And he was a Kabbalist. But we do not, there's no trace of that in the Shulchan Aruch. There's no trace of it. Even though he did, it's another lifestyle.
But the halacha is not inspired without saying it.
It doesn't, exactly. It's purely the Rishonim. There will be later commentators who are very much influenced by what's written in the Zohar, etc. But he's really, for the most part, stays away from it. And then what happens is that the Rama again noticed that the Shulchan Aruch also, it only was Svaradi halacha, Rif, Rambam, and the Rosh. You know, and the Rosh, okay, one of the Ashkenazim, but he always paskins according to the majority. So what did the Rama do? He wrote the Hegiot. He wrote his glosses, which is called the Mapa. He writes the table, he presents the table on top of the set. The Shulchan, the tablecloth on top of the table. And there's this whole play on words, and they go together. And this indeed lends the Shulchan Aruch tremendous credibility. Because now, it is a practical halachic work with the greatest Svardi sage of his age, of Yosef Cairo from Tzfat, and Rav Moshe Isserles, who's one of the greatest Ashkenazi poskim of his age, and he resided in Krakow, Poland. So you have the combination of the two gives you both Ashkenazi and Svardi perspectives. And that lends credence to it. It gives it a certain validity in the eyes of its those who receive it. So this is the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. What did we finish? What was the last thing we did last week? We then looked at a full sugya and we studied it from the Gemara through the Beit Yosef, through the Rishonim, through the Beit Yosef, then to the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. And this was the issue of when. What's Mahadrin? What's the basic mitzvah for Chanukah? What's Mahadrin? What's Mahadrin? Mina Mahadrin? What are all the different levels? And so this is what we studied last week. And now we're going to get to the next piece, and this is the next part of the story. The next part of the story is opposition and acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch. So with the book's written, okay, and you have the Hegiot, Harama, this all happens around, I don't know, the 1570s, okay? The book is compiled, both Ashkenazi and Sephardi. But are Jews going to accept it? Are other rabbis going to accept this as a legitimate halachic source? Okay, what are going to be the criticisms of it? Who's going to accept it? Who's going to oppose it? Sephardim, Ashkenazim? So this is the question that we're looking at now. And what we're going to see, we're going to separate our analysis between the Ashkenazi world and the Sephardi world. In the Ashkenazi world, we're going to see three different types of criticism, three different reasons for critiquing the Shulchan Aruch. Some of them are more severe than others, but there's a range of responses, and we're going to look at them right now, three responses. After that, we will look at the Sephardi acceptance or opposition to the Shulchan Aruch. And I'll mention a little piece about what happens in Morocco to this day with regards to the Shulchan Aruch and the Raman, some controversy there.
So let's start. Mentioned earlier that the Yemenites do not take the Shulchan Aruch, but go purely for the Raman.
The Yemenites mostly, yeah. They tend to, I mean, even there, there's going to, you know, there's...
Right, but there's already a...
But there, you had yes, mentioned there's more, something. There's more of a dependence on the Raman. So let's look at page one. We're looking at a piece called it's the introduction to a sefer called Levush Mordechai, by Rabbi Mordechai Jaffe. Rabbi Mordechai Jaffe lived from 1530 to 1612. He was a rabbi in Prague. He fled to Venice after he was exiled from Venice because of Christian persecutions. He stays in Venice for 10 years. He studies astronomy in Venice and then goes back to Prague. Now, he is a student of Rav Moshe Isserles, the Rama. And he's also a student of another great rabbi who we'll see in just a little bit, by the name of the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria. And he was a Rosh Yeshiva in Prague. He's a very learned person, one of the leading rabbis in this time. And he moves back from Italy to Moravia, or Bohemia, wherever it was at this point in time. Now he's going to tell us his story, because he's a very interesting story about what happens when he sees this book, the Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch, for the first time. Okay, so let's study this inside, and we're going to see that what the first criticism is of this work by the Levush.
Doesn't start with Acharei Moti, right? This is the
other
page. This is the other page.
So this is, but he's just going to quote the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef said, well, you know, Torah is dispersed, and you know, nothing's found in one book. You have to look at all these different books. So let's go to line number 8. Go to line number 8, Vilachin, second word. Okay? You see that? Vilachin bachar huzal. And therefore he, the Shulchan Aruch, decided to write a book, Sifro HaGadol B'derech Aruka Uktara, K'mo Shekatav Sham Hu Zichrona Livracha Yin Sham. He decided to write a very long book, the Beit Yosef. This is the Rav Yosef Karo, and a short book, the Shulchan Aruch.
Short.
Vayi kibo ha-sefer ahu rishona ba'artot halalu, ha'idu. When this book came to our lands, when it reached Moravia, Bohemia, lands of Ashkenaz in Germany, samchu alav kolum de ha-Torah, v'nasachim l'chased yakar v'la b'nei korav, ki chashvu l'kitzur k'neged ribu ha-svarim. When they saw this book, they were rejoiced, they were so happy. What an amazing resource that they had at their fingertips. They saw that he was providing grain to all of the inhabitants of the land, just like Yosef.
There's a play in words.
Again, another play in words. Yosef HaTzadik in Mitzrayim, and also Yosef Karo. It is the best. It is a superior work because it contains all of the opinions. And even me in my young years, as I have been like Motse Shalal Rav Hamadativ and Dehu, Adrot Dorshiv, Hashkan of Shibom, Old Bakhativ, Agot Bokoi, Mehayoti, Vishlachti Kosh Araposkim, Achare Gavai. Okay, he says, and I also threw myself into this. I love this book. However, Achberovayamim, Raiti Vid Bonanti. But after a little bit, I recognized, I realized that his path is so long. The Beit Yosef is voluminous. It's massive. It's too big. For the Beit Yosef, this encyclopedic work was at his fingertips. But for us, it's too long. You got to go through every page. I mean, hundreds of sources on every single issue. And he quotes all of them word for word. I mean, you can't summarize. It's not a summary. It's an encyclopedia. As Amarti Elech Li Ba'akva Vershon Li Kutzur Gdanim Al Piyas Kamato Shekatav Li Yishein Al Shloshem Odei Arazal. Then I said, fine, you know what? Let me write a condensed version of the Beit Yosef. Perfect, right? He's going to write...
Who's doing this?
This is the Levush Mordechai. This is all the Levush Mordechai.
That was before the Shulchan Aruch?
This is before the Shulchan Aruch is written. Exactly. This is we're going to see.
They all have the same idea.
And then what happens? Aval esperem v'tameim. Okay, but what did I want to do? Esperem v'tameim v'darchei kitzur she'efshar v'zeh hachli v'asot. But I'll give the rationale behind the halacha. I'll give a little bit of the reason for it. Vayacharei advarim eli atza ketzav milivnei Hashem b'gzirat gerush be'eretz milatati medinat fihem. But then God's wrath fell upon us, and I had to leave, and I went to Italy, the land of Italy, from Prague. I came to Venezia, Venice, on the water. But then by the time I got to Venice, I realized that he had already written a condensed version. And what's that called? It's called the Shulchan Aruch. By the way, all the printing, a lot of the printing was done in Venice. He's at the center of the
Venice
printing.
Venice was the center. Yeah. Ashkenazi and Sephardi, right?
Yeah, Venice was a very interesting city at this time because... You know, it's a multi-ethnic Jewish city. You have the Romaniot community, you have the Italian community, the Ashkenazim, you have the Sephardim, you have Ottomans, you have all different types of Jews all in one ghetto. Okay, it's really, you know, a plurality. So I stopped my work because I realized that he'd done this work. I said, just like I got you know, reward for... doing the work, I also get work, you know, reward for, you know, preventing me from stopping.
La prisha. Okay. La prisha. Okay.
Yanki and Marty.
Same story than the Rama, right? Same.
A little bit. This back and forth. Exactly. Yanki and Marty. Ayayi yet tarachti b'chinam kiim achabrenu la'acher vada yeh l'kitzor yad v'shem gadol me'od ki hu bala bayit b'atzmo yudea motzio mova'av chadera v'liotav v'liot tachtiot shali kelo haya yiyeh. And he says... you know what? Better that the Rav Yosef Karo write his own abridged version to this work.
He knows
the work. It's his bayit. He knows the different floors, the different rooms, the corners. He knows all this stuff. So what? Why should I do this? Let's go to the next page. Second line here. But then by the time we got to Venezia, before Sefer Zeh Venezia, Raiti. Then I realized that what he'd written as the Shulchan Aruch was too short. The first one is too long. Now this is too short. And if you read it, it's like reading a closed book. It's like a dream without. It's like a dream without any resolution, without any explanation. He doesn't give any explanations. It's just like pure raw. Kemarti makom achad iniach li. Rav li itkaber on page 2. Li itkaber bo. Ki hum ahimshich tekatav rav adinim api dat harambam zal mitnei shanogim bo vartod Yishmael. Shu harav beit yosef zal ayam manigim bro sham. Uveilo artod barov enogim ken. As amarti ashubun nachti. So first of all, he says the work is too short. It doesn't give any rationale, no explanation for the halachot.
And
secondly, he says, and it's Sfaradi, and it's from Eretz Yishmael, and we are Ashkenazim here. So as amarti ashuv limlachti lichtov livaer oto adanim anogim be'elu arzot Ashkenaz pian Moravian Poland Russia Vagabin v'toch kach v'od ha'it b'venetz yatzah akol b'machaneh v'yak yadanim mori harav. And as I'm doing this, I realize that so he starts his second time to write his own work, and then he hears, when he's still in Venetia, that Rema, his own rabbi, Rav Moshe Israelis, b'gilak doshab karkov, nitorer ala derech hazeh asher bahartili. So he started doing it. So he's like, okay, so he stops for the second time. And now he gets to the third time. Okay, let's go to the next paragraph.
It's amazing how they all had the same idea, right? The hot potato.
But then he doesn't like what the Ramah does. Why? Because it's also too short. So we're in the third word, the last word in the first line. Okay, we're reading a work, the introduction of the Rav Mordechai Jaffe, okay? Mm-hmm. The work of the Levush. And he's commenting on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, most famous code in Jewish law, but it's so thin. It doesn't contain any explanations, no sources, no derivations, nothing. It's just the pure law. And he's saying it's too thin, it's too bare, it's too sparse. You need the spirit. You need an explanation. You need the philosophy behind the halacha. Okay, so v'ra'iti ki katzor katzor yadam me'od ki gam Rabbeinu Moshe zal alach b'igver Rav Yosef Karo zal ela shoziv minagei el ha'artot. So at least the Rama added resolved one problem. He put the Ashkenazi comments in, but it's still too short. Okay, as ra'iti v'amarti hinei ata higia le'id lachzor limachtei rishon. And now I said I'm going to go back to my original decision. And I'm going to write something. And he writes 10 volumes, a 10-volume work. They've given me space to do something here. Their way is very different than mine. They know all of halacha by heart. They don't need an explanation. But we regular people, we need an explanation and a rationale for the halacha. Now he's going to use this wordplay. This is brilliant. They set out this beautiful table with all this amazing, exquisite delicacies and food. But it's like food without salt. You can't eat this food if it has no taste. There's no salt. There's no spice in it. So let's just read the bottom here, which captures everything in English. The Chavod Daniel.
Okay, Shulchan Aruch is like a sealed book, a dream which had no interpretation or meaning. It is like a table well prepared with all kind of refreshment, but dishes are tasteless, lacking the salt of reasoning, which makes the broth boil and warms the individual, lacking a minimum of explanatory or exhortatory Torah material to embellish and spiritualize the bland halachic directives. This is your translation, basically, a summary of the...
Exactly, a little bit of a summary. Okay, now, this is a pretty serious critique, right? He's saying the Shulchan Aruch is very practical. It's too practical. It's too sparse.
It's a critique in the form, not in the substance. He does not criticize the principle of decision making.
Well, the substance a little bit. Well, he does a little bit. He says he left out all the Ashkenazi customs, but then the Rama added that in, so there's no need to respond to that. So he, but this is a serious critique, and this is a reasonable critique, and we're going to see what Rabbi Dr. Yitzchak Twersky in his article, The Enduring Code of Jewish Law, page 3, what he has to say in response to this.
So
okay, first he's going to capture.
When was that?
This was written. He's a professor in Harvard. Okay, this is we spoke about him last week. He's a professor of Hebrew literature at Harvard.
Is he still alive?
No, he passed away in 1996. He's the son-in-law of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik.
Okay,
and he's also a Hasidic Rebbe, the Talmud Rebbe. So he's a professor at Harvard and a Hasidic Rebbe.
He's not the Boston Rebbe.
He's different. So he's going to first explain what Rabbi Mordechai Jaffe, what his critique was in his own words. And then he's going to disagree with him.
Tu veux dire, Laila?
Okay. Okay. So let's read this. In effect, Rabbi Mordechai Jaffe, whose code was a potential but short-lived rival to the Shulchan Aruch, so it's a rival for a short bit, but it doesn't really win out, addressed himself to the problem which great halachists, ethicists, philosophers, and mystics have constantly confronted: how to maintain a rigid, punctilious observance of the law and concomitantly avoid externalization and routinization. Okay. On one end, we hear the echoes of Maimonides, Rabbi Lezer HaRokeach affirms, Rabbi Menachem Ben Zerach, author of the Tzedek LaDerech, who attempt to combine laws with their reasons and rationale, as well as Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pekuda, Rabbi Yonah Grond, and Rabbi Yitzchak Abuav, to mention just a few of his predecessors. On the other hand, this tone continues to reverberate in the Shulchan Aruch of Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, as well as in the writings of Rav Isaiah Hurwitz and Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, to mention just a few of his successors. The common denominator here is the concern that the halachic enterprise always be rooted and related to spirituality, to knowledge of God obtained through study and experience. All difficulties notwithstanding, it was generally felt that even when dealing with a corpus of practical, clearly definable law, attempts should be made to express the perhaps incommunicable values and aspirations of religious experience and spiritual existence. What he's saying here is you can't just have the dry law without the spirit. You can't have the dry law without the philosophy, the rationale, the explanation, the ethics, the spiritual aspirations behind halacha. You need that to infuse the halacha. And that is lacking in this work.
It's interesting because he's including the Rambam as somebody who's giving explanation. Although the Rambam doesn't give explanation, but he gives a philosophical context. He gives a philosophical context. He explains what you said
We're saying there exactly. There are earlier works who had this issue, who responded to this issue, and later works also. Yes, exactly. So the Rambam does give rationale for a lot of the mitzvot. He tries to.
Yeah.
You know, he does try to. He doesn't do it for everything. Oh, but he does it for a lot.
Is he finished?
Okay. Yeah, finished. Okay.
Do you want
that? Yeah, a little bit of this. Thank you. But now he is going to sort of respond. And it's going to be a delicate... It's going to be a delicate response. It's not going to be a full, you know, frontal attack. But he is going to respond. Would you mind reading this?
However? Yeah, yes. However, when all is said, it would be incorrect and insensitive to assert unqualifiedly that the Shulchan Aruch, that embodiment of halacha, which Jewish history has proclaimed supreme, is spiritless, formalistic, even timid work.
He's saying that would be missing the point here. It's not that.
Its opening sentence, especially as elaborated by Rabbi Moshe Israelis, acts as the nerve center of the entire halachic system and the fountain of its strength.
So he's quoting now, these are the first words of the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama.
So a man should make himself strong and brave as a lion, to rise in the morning for the service of his Creator, so that he should awake the down I have said the Lord always before
so
me.
So that he should awake the dawn.
Okay. So he should be there, you know, before the sunrise, basically.
Yeah. And now the Rama. So that's the Shulchan Aruch. Yidgaber ka'ari la'amod baboker. Wake up like a lion in the morning. And then the Rama responds, I've set the Lord always before me. Shiviti Hashem le'nevitamid. This is a cardinal principle that run the perfect noble ways of the righteous who walk before God. For man does not sit, move, and occupy himself when he is alone in his house, as he sits, moves, and occupies himself when he's in the presence of a great king. Nor does he speak and rejoice while he is with his family and relatives as he speaks in the king's council. How much more so when man takes to heart that the great king, the holy one, blessed be he, whose glory fills the whole earth, is always standing by him and observing all his doings, as it is said in scripture, can a man hide himself in secret places that I shall not see him? Cognizant of this, he will immediately achieve reverence and humility, fear and shame before the Lord, blessed be he, at all times. Okay, so what he's saying, he's saying, you want to tell me there's no, this is spirit right here. So this is what he says. Law is dry and its details are burdensome only if its observance lacks vital commitment. But if all actions of a person are infused with a radical awareness that he's acting in the presence of God, then every detail becomes meaningful and relevant. Such an awareness rules out routine, mechanical actions. Everything must be conscious and purposive in a God-oriented universe. Every step of man is directed towards God. Halacha, like nature, abhors a vacuum. It recognizes no twilight zone of neutrality or futility. It is all inclusive. Okay, so we see here he's saying it's not dry, but it demands a little bit more, depth, a little bit more commitment. If you're committed to the details, then in fact can be very meaningful. So he's shifting, you know, what it means for something to have spiritual substance to it. But he is he's making a very good point in response to Rav Mordechai Jaffe, to the Lavush Mordechai.
It's defense of the Shulchan Aruch.
Yeah, exactly. That is the first critique of the Shulchan Aruch. Now we're going to get to the second one. And the second one is put out by Rabbi by the name of the Maharshal, of Shlomo Luria. Mareinu Harav Shlomo Luria. That's his the abbreviation. He's a contemporary of the Rama and an interlocutor of the Rama. So he disagrees with the Rama, as we're going to see in halachic areas, very significantly. But he's also going to disagree with the Rama about philosophy. The Rama was interested in philosophy and astronomy and astrology and science and all these things. The Lavush, is the Maharshal, is very much against the study of these things. Okay, and he's a very prominent rabbi. One of the great rabbis in Poland in this time, lives from 1510 to 1573 in Poland.
Any connection with Yitzhak, the Ari?
Oh, the Arizal? I don't think so, but it's a good
question. Was the Arizal...
And they live at the exact same time.
Was the Arizal Ashkenazi?
I think he was...
Is Loria Ashkenazi?
Loria
doesn't look like Ashkenazi.
I think he is... I always forget whether he's Ashkenazi or Sephardi. He lived in Egypt, I know. I think he's... Ashkenazi.
He's so beyond.
I think he's maybe Sephardi. I always forget what that result is.
He's above, right? Above a denomination. Yeah.
So he's going to, his critique here, and I'm using here an article by Rabbi Shlomo Brody, the critique of by the Maharshal. But let's look at the Hakdama of the Yamshel Shlomo. The Yamshel Shlomo, the Sea of Solomon, is the name of his work because his name is Shlomo. And it's a commentary on the Gemara. And he explains the halachic process. And he says, every single rabbi in each generation needs to build his altar, needs to build his sacrificial altar of halacha. And every rabbi in his time needs to make a judgment. He's like weighing the different evidence in each direction. This is why the Torah was given to rabbis of every generation. Every rabbi, according to the depth of his chotzev, his lachtsov, is to dig, his ability to plumb, to dig, plumb the depths of these sort, the Talmud, to dig in, to understand the these issues. The chelak liilui lo sif kifimashi yiru lo min hashamayim. What he's saying here is that every generation, each rabbi needs to weigh the evidence that comes before him. And he needs to do this. He needs to start from the beginning of the process, to go over it, to find what he thinks, how to determine halacha. He he's going to totally disagree with this process of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah that we're going to pick the three best guys that came before us. He said, what are you talking about? Every rabbi needs to go back to the Talmud, go back to the original sources, and look them over again and clarify for himself the halacha and then make piskei halacha based on that. But you can't have this system where you pick out the majority rules. What is this? Rolling dice? Are we playing risk here? What is this? No, you have to, every rabbi needs to use their seichel, hayashar. Okay, so let's read inside. B'chavod, for Luria.
Okay, for Luria, however, the Talmud not only proves the futility of the Mishnah project, but also positively perceives the priority of voices within the halachic tradition. So it's interesting. Here he said the Talmud is actually disagreeing on the Mishnah, which gives very simple, concise halacha, or discussion that are concise, and the Talmud explode all that.
Well, he wants to return. He sees the Talmud
as essential.
And the method of the Talmud, of there being different opinions, and it's not clearly determined what the answer is. He wants to maintain that process, that dynamic process of Talmudic analysis, which has been stymied and cut off because of the codifications of the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, keep going.
One should not fear machloket, since each opinion represents one of the different facets of Torah. Marshall subsequently cites a number of Talmudic sources that embrace halachic pluralism. In addition to its infeasibility, the codification of halacha represents an undesirable repression of the plurality of Torah. Marshall emulates...
No, he doesn't like codes. He believes that codes themselves are detrimental to the halachic system. Because a code, by definition, is limiting the plurality of the Talmud. I'm saying it's always like this. The rule's always like this. But he says, no. You have to determine based on each context. Each situation.
But, okay. Yeah. But I mean, now, even rabbis who follow the Shulchan Aruch still have some leeway according to the urgency of the time and the situation. So it's not exactly... Exactly.
But he thinks there should be more.
You should
go back to the Talmud and study everything from the beginning.
Okay.
And not depend on the code and not determine, it's almost like bias. The system is biased. Like, why are we choosing to follow the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh over everybody else? And why are we choosing the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah for everybody else? Right? Go back to the Gemara and find the most logical explanation of the Sugya and understanding of the Sugya.
Yeah. Okay. Marshall emulates the independence of these figures and urges contemporary scholars to follow their lead in analyzing the text for themselves. He describes his predecessors as assuming full prerogative to adjudicate the law.
He's saying every rabbi needs to has the power to determine halacha. Not everyone, not every local rabbi, but great scholars certainly do. So too must a contemporary posek join this pluralistic tradition and follow his own interpretation of the Torah. Marshall does not believe that one should ignore earlier commentators. He chides Rambam for ignoring the French sages, while commending Ramban for recognizing the genius of the Ashkenazi interpreters. He extols utilizing all available resources to properly analyze the text. Yet ultimately, the sage must rule according to his own insight. This insight echoes, albeit with important differences, the claim later stressed by Rav Chaim ben Bezalel. The codification stymies the dynamic process in which the posek applies law to each unique case according to his own perception. The interpretation of the Talmud serves as the central factor for Luria's Psak Halacha. As he succinctly, yet forcefully writes, HaTalmud huwa machriya v'harayot berot yitztaku v'itnu adayen. The Talmud is you have to look at the evidence in each direction. Searching for the true meaning of the text, lachkor achar shorash ha'inyan, the scholar must allow for no preconceived notions or prejudices toward certain interpreters to bias his read. Luria testifies that he spent days upon days on one... See, now we're going to see the problem with this method.
Right.
He spent days upon days on one single sugya until his understanding of it reached his satisfaction. The necessary dedication of understanding any sugya also presents an additional reason for the imprudence of codification. To complete the project, one will sacrifice clarity and accuracy. But this is a problem. If every day rabbi is spending... can't finish it. In his second act of Malchut, Nuri himself admits the yoga of comprehensive study overwhelms him and hinders his ability to complete his project. He furthermore fears that God will hold him responsible for not helping the larger public by bringing his project to fruition. Nonetheless, he remains steadfast in his ways, content that depth and precision take primacy in uncovering the truth of the Talmud. You have to appreciate his ambition, you know, his ambitious project. And it's true, you know, he's saying, you know, it's almost, it's a little bit, it's cutting corners a little bit. It's taking the shortcut. When the Shulchan Aruch says, the Beit Yosef says, I'm not going to determine who's right and wrong in the sugya. I'm just going to, we have the opinions, I'm going to collect everything and just determine based on the big three. He's saying that is undermining the whole halachic system. So he really is against these codes. This is a very severe critique.
Now, the disadvantage of, you know, the problem with that approach is that then there is no one common halacha.
Exactly.
And then you run the risk of division within the.
Exactly.
I mean, there is always a division between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, but that's a little bit different. Those are traditions and whatever, but if within the same city or Krakow, the rabbi here said that, the other rabbi said that, then we have no...
Well, it's an interesting question. Would it be so bad if everyone were doing something different as long as they followed what their community or their rabbi said? It's an interesting question.
Right.
It raises interesting questions. But you're right. I mean, how valuable is halachic unity or uniformity versus halachic truth, if you will, right? You
right.
know, these are questions. Okay, so this is the second critique of the Shulchan Aruch, different from the Lavush Mordechai. Lavush complains that there's no spirit, doesn't include any of the spirit of the law. The Maharshal claims that the whole process
it's
of codification...
It's an essential, really, the
yeah,
principle.
The whole process of codification is eliminating, you know, Talmudic, dialectic, and analysis, and plurality. And diversity of opinion. And I'm okay. And this undermines the entire process. And now we're going to look at the third critique. Okay, the third critique has to do a little bit more with the Rama. Okay? And the location or the geographic... well, let's look at... I'm not sure quite how to explain it right now, but let's look inside for a second, okay? So we're going to see a critique by Rabbi Chaim ben Bezalel, who is the brother of the Maharal. Well, let's look at the bottom of page 4.
The bottom of page 4, okay.
Yeah. Now, Rav Moshe Isserles writes, he brings in all, you know, we haven't unpacked this word Ashkenazi. What is an Ashkenazi? What is an Ashkenazi Jew? And
Originally coming from Ashkenaz?
Where is Ashkenaz? What does that mean? What's Ashkenaz? Originally, it was France and Germany.
Yiddish speaking.
Originally, okay. So you're saying it's linguistic. It's
but French is not Ashkenaz, right? French is not.
Originally Yiddish. Ashkenaz was the lands of Germany and France, okay, in the early Middle Ages. The problem is that most of the Jews are no longer in France and Germany because they've been kicked out of France and Germany and they moved to Poland, and not only Poland, but you have Ashkenazi communities in Italy, Ashkenazi communities in the Ottoman Empire, and Salonika has 28 different communities, okay? You have Ashkenazi Jews there. You have Ashkenazi Jews in Israel. Should they follow the customs of their rabbis in France and Germany? Or are they following the local customs? Are they, like, what should they do? What is it to be an Ashkenazi Jew? And we assume today, you know, oh, there's Sfaradim and Ashkenazim.
There's more than
that. The truth is, but it wasn't always that way, that there were Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. This idea of this distinction between these two different locations and distinct locations came into, you know, it happened at a certain, you know, it evolved. This idea came into formation over time. It wasn't clear cut. In the time of the Rama, as we're going to see in just a second, there was no, if you would have asked someone, what is Ashkenazi Jewry? They would have said, what are you talking about? There are Jews in Moravia, Bohemia, Germany, Poland, Russia, Lithuania. Who says that they're all Ashkenazi Jews?
Interesting. That concept is something that is created more recently.
Exactly. Well, we're going to see.
And then you have the Edot HaMizrach.
We're going to see that Professor Joseph Davis, actually, we're going to see in just a second, argues that the Rama, the work of the Rama, the Mapa, actually helps to create this consciousness of a pan-Ashkenazi world and pan-Ashkenazi custom. And it's through the spread of the Rama that the Shulchan Aruch, that this... that this comes into formation. So let's look at this right now.
Interesting.
So let's look at the bottom of page 4. Now this is the title page, and we're going to, interesting how certain historical factors played a role here. Okay, because this is the title page of the Krakow edition of the Shulchan Aruch in 1570. Krakow publisher Isaac of Prosnitz. And he writes this follows. It's just the introduction to the book, right? You have an introduction to a book here where it says what it is, you know?
Yeah,
it's the same thing, explains what it is. So it says here, Shulchan Aruch .. written by Rav Yosef Karo, with many comments by Moshe Israelis, and a guide to the customs of Poland, Russia, Lithuania, Bohemia, Moravia, and Germany. And Germany. Okay?
Not France.
Now, not France.
Or England, now, or whatever. No.
Yeah, no, it doesn't say France. He just says in Germany, because Jews weren't living in France at the time. They'd been kicked out of Germany.
Oh, they were kicked out of France.
Okay? Now, this is interesting that it includes the word Germany here. Because if you look at the actual Hakdama of the Raman, the Shulchan Aruch, go to page 5. You go to the actual Hakdama itself, on the bottom of page 5. We read this last week. He explains he's going to give the customs, the Ashkenazi customs. Okay, look at the boldface words. L'arot derech ha-minagim shenagu b'midinot elu. But what does b'midinot elu mean? In these countries. Okay? But what are these countries? The publisher decided, what does this mean? It means Poland, Russia, Lithuania, Bohemia, Moravia, and Germany. But the Rama, it's not clear who the Rama thinks his halachot
at least from
are relevant for.
At least Poland, right?
At least Poland. Everyone agrees Poland. The question is, does it include Germany or not? So let's see what Rav Chaim ben Bezalel says in a sefer called Vikuach Maim Rabin, commentary on the Rama's Torah Chatat. So I have a Hebrew version here and an English version. Let's read a little bit of the Hebrew version, then we'll go to the English. Okay? Not just 1 second.
He's talking about Bnei Ashkenaz.
Yeah.
He's talking about Bnei Ashkenaz. Bnei Mizrach or Bnei Ashkenaz.
Ah, okay. Let's go to the, like 6 lines up from the bottom.
From the bottom. Okay.
Uvahakdamat hamagia, zachar beferush Polania, Rusia, fihem, and Moravia, Marin. Okay, PM must be PM, Bahim, Bohemia. Verachiv Oded Gvul, the Katab Ulai, Bohoma Komasher, Tasig Lashon Ashkenaz.
Lashon.
Okay, he says in all places of Lashon Ashkenaz, Ben and Yudim. So it's unclear, is it included in Bnei Ashkenaz? He's referring to Germany, right? But the publisher added the word Ashkenaz. So it's not clear in the Rama's language whether it includes Ashkenaz. But he, the publisher, added Ashkenaz, Germany. So let's read this in English.
Now, was it printed in the life of the Rama?
This commentary?
No, the Shulchan Aruch.
Yes,
Did the Rama,
and he didn't seem to object to what
he didn't say anything.
He didn't object to it, so it seems like maybe
tells you something already, right?
Yeah, so let's see what he says. There's a great need. Go for it in English.
Okay, there's a great need to assert the differences between the customs of the Jews of Germany, Bnei Ashkenaz, and those of the land of Poland. Rabbi Israel himself, in his introduction to Torah Hatat, did not mention the customs of Germany at all, but only those of his own land. The introduction of the proofreader, however, mentioned explicitly Poland, Ukraine, Bohemia, and Moravia. And he extended the borders even farther, and wrote, and perhaps every place where German, Lashon Ashkenaz, is spoken by Jews. one may see that he expressed uncertainty whether the book applied to German Jews, Bnei Ashkenaz, or not. So the printer added on his own and mentioned Germany as well on the title page, so that he would increase his sale of all his,
you know,
of all those land, because buyer always look at the beginning of the book.
Okay, this is right.
When was that written?
This is written in the 1500s, late 1500s.
Increase the sale. That's interesting.
Okay, but you see here.
That's interesting.
You see here. There's a contemporary of the Rama. You see here that the. This is one of the questions. Does the Rama apply to Germany or only to Poland and Lithuania, the east of that?
You know, he's done some, you know, criticism of the It's like a scholar, you know, mm-hmm. like oh, he yes. could be a.
No, he's a German rabbi in Prague. He's basically saying this.
But 1500. I mean, it could be a 20th century. You know, quick and say, oh, you know, he changed the thing mm-hmm. and he was just trying to get sales. This is like a very, mm-hmm. you know, I don't hear many rabbis saying these kind of things.
It's pretty sharp. It's pretty cool. Yeah. Now, okay, so now I want to look, let's go to page 6. An article by Joseph Davis of Grates College, an article called The Reception of the Shulchan Aruch. And he argues that he tries to identify how did this concept, this idea of Ashkenazi Jewry come about. Okay, because it's in formation, as we spoke about, during this time period. And he basically points out that the truth is that even in Germany, there are many different areas in Germany and regions, and that there was no fixed idea of Ashkenazi Jewry. Right? It wasn't so clear, oh, I'm Ashkenazi, you're Ashkenazi, we're all Ashkenazim. Or people
there was no
like
German
that.
Nation.
There was, exactly.
The nation.
People said, I come from the area of Alsace-Lorraine.
Yes.
I come from the area of Pressburg. I'm from Prague. And that's how, you know, halachat was determined.
The concept of nation of Germany, or nation-state is...
He even gives there's a very extreme example, that Maharil, who was a great chazan, so he prayed one year as a chazan, just forgetting where he prayed. He prayed in one year in, it's in the Sefer Maharil, in Hilchot Yom Kippur, also Shelot Teshuvot number 76, Maharil. He was a great German rabbi. And he prayed in one area, and he didn't follow the local customs on Yom Kippur. And apparently his daughter passed away, and he attributed his daughter's death to the fact that he didn't follow the local customs. And again, you see that there wasn't this pan-Ashkenazi custom. There was a local custom in that location, that region where he was praying, and you know that's just one example. Anyway, but he's going to then point out, so how did Ashkenazi Jewry get its consciousness, its awareness of, you know, that we are a unique Jewry with a set standard of halacha based on the Rama. And so he writes about it in this article. And he says at the end here, as we have seen, there are a number of different factors, but this is the primary one. We have seen the Jews of the lands of the Polish Grand Bohemia, Moravia, and Germany were not typically a unanimous group. Why did the German or Bohemian or Moravian or Lithuanian Jews not accept some other legal code? Like, why did they end up accepting the Rama? Because they practically did. Why? How'd that happen? There were enough to choose from medieval codes as well as more recent ones. So he now gives an explanation. The political scientist Leah Greenfield, in her analysis of the rise of nationalism in the modern period, emphasizes the role played by imitative pressure, which she calls resentment. French nationalism was inspired by British nationalism, German nationalism by French, and so on. Mutatis mutandis, this notion may be applied to our story. The wealthier, more eminent, and more populous Sephardic communities pressed against Ashkenazi Jews of the 16th century in many realms, such as theology and educational practice. Isserlis felt the pressure especially keenly in the realm of law. In opposition to Maimonides, on whom the Sephardic rabbinate relied, Isserlis played Rashi and the Tosfos, the sages from whose waters we drink. So he was propping up the Balei Tosafot as sort of an opposition, a response to the Sephardim. Solomon Luria, who rejected the rationalism of Spanish Jewry, found space in the introduction to his great work of jurisprudence to include a diatribe against Maimonides and also against, of all people, the Spanish Bible commentator Abraham Ibn Ezra. Isserlis's character was to avoid polemics, but the double form that he created for the Shulchan Aruch, with its contrasting sections of Karo's rulings and his own comments, also placed Ashkenazi Judaism in implicit opposition to Spanish or Oriental Judaism. Before 1492, Sfarad, Spain, and Ashkenaz Germany were simply two of the many lands in which Jews lived, each with its own traditions and customs. After 1492, Sephardic identity was released from the bounds of geography and was based instead on communal association, lineage, and language. Similarly, the definition of Ashkenaz was extended in these ways.
So the Shulchan Aruch created identity.
So is the Shulchan Aruch, Sephardi Jewry, they already had this sort of identity coming from Spain, you know, but that created counter-response of Ashkenazim. Yeah, it created a process. One thing leads to the next, the domino effect, and ultimately you have the creation of a unified Ashkenazi worldview, a consciousness, an awareness that we're sort of part of this larger group that's in opposition to the Sephardim, or different than, an alternative to the Sephardim, which is really fascinating about how this is created. Another thing that helped to determine this was that many of the Rama's students left Poland and went to places like Germany and spread his Torah. So there was also like an expansion of his Torah. You know, he had many great students. The Rav Yoshua Falk, who wrote commentaries on the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch, the Sma, the Drisha, the Parisha. You have different commentators who are students of, and as we saw, that the Levush is again a student of the Rama. He agrees with the Rama about the Pesach Halacha. Okay, so now we're done with Ashkenaz. We have seen how Ashkenaz Jewry formed very much as a response and in the process because of the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. Now we get to page 7. In page 7, and with this we'll finish off this piece, with an article by Dr. Tzvi Zohar, Sephardic Jurisprudence in the Recent Half Millennium. And the question is, what happens in the Sephardic world following the authorship of the Shulchan Aruch? Now, what do you think is going to happen? Is it going to be like the Ashkenazi world where there's sort of this opposition but ultimate acceptance? What do you think is going to happen in the Sephardi world?
I don't expect much opposition to that.
Well, why not? Are they more or less likely to be opposed to the Shulchan Aruch?
My feeling, and I didn't read what he wrote here, is that they would be less likely.
Why?
Maybe because there's not such a same culture of the Gemara, studying the Gemara, maybe. Or, I don't know if this is
even more
or
basic
not.
Than that. The Shulchan Aruch is based on Sephardi poskim.
Right.
So they're going to say, great, Riff, Rambam.
Yeah, this is, I mean, good. This is our territory. Yeah.
Exactly, their territory. Okay, so.
But, I mean, conceptually, there may be less difficulty because maybe the majority are not really eager to reinvent the wheel each time they want to have and go to the source. Mm-hmm. Although, mm-hmm. I mean, I can see how this the big criticism about the concept here. This was the Marshall, right?
Marshall, yeah.
Yeah, I can see how now there are still a lot of people who follow that approach. So you really have to go back to the
Gemara. Okay, so let's look at Dr. Tzvi Zohar. Reception of the Shulchan Aruch. While the Messiah did not arrive in 16th century Tzfat, Rabbi Yosef Karo's hopes for the Shulchan Aruch were not completely in vain. It attained an almost sacrosanct status in halachic discourse. In the lands of the Ottoman Empire, so this is Sephardi territory, right? The Shulchan Aruch's, the Shulchan's dominance was achieved quite rapidly. By the end of the 16th century, Rabbi Eliyahu Bar Chaim, Turkey, 1536-10, declared unequivocally, "He, Joseph Karo, has been accepted by us here as our master. We have committed ourselves to follow his rulings." An oral tradition related that 200 contemporary rabbis convened and voted to accept Karo's innovative procedure of determining halacha by following the majority of Rif, Rambam, and Rush. While that convention may well be a myth, the myth itself reflected a widespread attitude regarding the Shulchan's validity. In the Torah centers of Eastern and Central Europe, a high status was not only easily obtained by the Shulchan, nevertheless, by the 17th century, the Shulchan became the authoritative work of halacha. So it's almost totally accepted. But now we're going to see the Shulchan Aruch as supreme authority myth and fact. That's not so clear-cut. The widespread reception of the Shulchan resulted in increased uniformity. This implied a dual assault on the independence of local rabbis, authorities, and on the particularity of local customs. What may be seen as a reaction to these threats, communities asserted their uniqueness and independence by stressing local custom and mores, an area considered independent of the Shulchan's rule. As put by Rabbi Yosef Malcho, Salonika 18th century, we were obligated to his Karu's decisions only in matters in which no specific practice or custom previously obtained. But as for matters in which long accepted norms were practiced, custom continued to prevail despite the spread of his rulings.
Oh.
So what happened is that while he created this uniformity of halacha, it also, people, it met with some resistance by local customs. People said, well, this is what we've been doing for a long time. You can't just change it from the Shulchan, based on the Shulchan Aruch. Also, you know, so there is, you know, here they're saying here, well, we follow the Shulchan Aruch when we don't know what to do. But when we know what to do, we have our local customs, we follow those. When adopted as basic policy by rabbis, such an attitude can lead to what may be termed halachic insularity. Almost any praxis claimed to be locally normative is ipso facto rendered impervious to material deliberation or critique, especially by non-local masters. Concomitantly, halachic works by masters of other communities can be regarded as a purely academic interest, since only, quote, local authorities are ultimately binding. Such virtual islands of halacha must, of course, be understood in its ideal type, never fully realized. Yet the centrifugal force of this position may well account for much of the halachic differentiation that continued to characterize Sephardic jurisprudence after the 16th century, despite the canonization of the Shulchan Aruch, improved communication, and the diffusion of print. And he's saying it's interesting. Even after everyone accepts the Shulchan Aruch, there's still so many different customs in Sephardic lands. And the reason is because everyone held by this idea, well, what we're doing is fine, and that's how it's always been. And we follow the Shulchan Aruch when, you know, when we don't know what to do, or we don't have a psak halacha for this. So, but he's saying this process of uniting the entire Sephardi world has actually been completed, or attempted to be completed, by none other than Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. Right. It was only in the second half of the 20th century that a centripetal counterforce emerged in the form of Rabbi Ovadia Yosef's major campaign to instate the hegemony of Rabbi Yosef Karo throughout all Jewish ethnic groups. So he tries to really, to, I'd say, complete the mission of the Shulchan Aruch in practice, and in many ways he succeeds. So this is what happens in the Sephardi world. The Shulchan Aruch is accepted, and yet it still does meet resistance by local customs. And so,
for minor points.
Yeah, minor points, exactly. But overall, they do
major,
accept.
Major, right?
Exactly. There's no.
Is there anything big that would be critical?
You know, hey, well, we don't like this methodology, or we think that it's stymieing Talmudic discourse.
Right, right.
None of that. Okay.
I mean, also the Sfardim had the tradition already of valuing the Mishneh Torah.
Exactly.
Which already kind of bypassed the Gemara.
Exactly, exactly.
So they were already prepared with that.
They were already codified, if you will. They were used to codification.
The Ashkenazim already had a problem with the Mishneh Torah from the beginning. Also.
So just, I'm going to finish off with one final point in Morocco. So in Morocco, they immediately accepted the Shulchan Aruch. But there's a lot of what happens when the Moroccans get to Israel. Rav Ovadia Yosef tries to delegitimize their halachic Misura. And he says, no, you have to follow the Shulchan Aruch. And so the Moroccans had this very strong and dynamic halachic tradition, which was Rav Ovadia Yosef was trying to, you know, cut off. And one of the attacks that Rav Ovadia has on the Moroccan poskim is that, well, you guys follow the Ashkenazim, you follow the Rama in many areas of halacha, okay? And this is like the ultimate insult, that you're following the Ashkenazim, a Sfaradi community, the North Africans, following the Rama. That's clearly an indication that their process of halachic interpretation is faulty.
Is he correct?
Flawed. Ah, so there's a book here. I have a book here called Divrei Shalom V'Emet, written by who's the author of this work? Rav Shlomo Toledano. Okay, excellent sefer. I think it's a relatively recent book, in which he responds to all of Rav Ovadia's critiques with the analysis of the Moroccan poskim and the North African, Tunisian, Libyan poskim.
Wow.
And one thing, and he says, is that there are times when it appears like the Moroccans are following the customs of the Ramah. But he says, if you look deeper into the issue, it's really not the case. I'll give you a classic example. Classic example is that the Moroccans make a bracha on Halel on Rosh Chodesh. Okay? Ashkenazim also do that. Eidot HaMizrach generally, Svaradim, according to Shulchan Aruch, you don't do that on Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh, you make no bracha. So the Moroccans seem to be following the Ramah. How do we explain this? So he points out in this book, he says, we're not following the Ramah. It was the custom of the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfazi. Where's the Rif from? He's from Morocco. The Moroccans were following their rabbi, the Rif. This was the original custom of the Rif. That's who they're following. That's why we make a bracha on Halel and Rosh Chodesh. It's not because they adapted the custom of the Ramah from Poland. So this is a classic example of how they, you know, respond to Rav Avadya. But what we have here, to just summarize here, we have a fascinating process. Because the writing of the Shulchan Aruch, the history that precedes it and that follows with it, it really captures many of the important themes in halakha. The differences between having an encyclopedic code that contains all the opinions versus something, a practical code, that tension, that conflict. The difference between having a code that just gives you the practical halakha and another code that spiritualizes halakha, that infuses it with meaning and philosophical, ethical basis. And the differences between those two things. Yeah, the difference between, you know, and big questions about authority. Where does a particular code have binding authority? Is it in Poland or also Germany? Okay, who gives the Ramah authority to determine halakha in all of Germany, right? This is an interesting and fascinating question about how his work came to be accepted. What are different methodologies of determining halakha? Do we follow halakha kebatrai, as the Ramah says, follow the later customs, local customs? Or do you follow the big three, the Rif, the Rambam, and Rabbeinu Asher, right? Should a rabbi return to the Talmud to determine halakha, or should he base himself on later sources? Should you be biased towards local customs, as the Ramah says one should, or the Maharshal says no? Forget about your local biases. Go back to the sources and figure out the truth. Forget about what, because someone was is Moroccan and you're Moroccan, you're going to just follow that? No, go back to the Talmud, see what's correct in the Talmud. So these are many of the fault lines within the halachic process. And they play out in the writing of the motivation, the impetus for writing the Shulchan Aruch, and the opposition and acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch over time. And so Chazak Uvaruch, Daniel Rosen for hosting, and we should all be zocheh to study all these works of halacha, to be able to infuse our lives both with the law itself and the spirit of halacha. Chazak Uvaruch.
Amen. Chazak.